Happy Easter solstice, Passover, Buddha's birthday, you name it. Happy this spring. I wanted to talk about some of my teachers to share them with you. This is our history. This is our lineage. They're not necessarily teachers that you guys knew or know. But most of them I think you know of. They're from San Francisco Zen Center, Berkeley Zen Center. What was it called? I think it was the San Diego Zen Center. Joko Beck, I'm thinking of it. When are we supposed to end this part?
Well, we usually get out sometime between 4 to 9 and 9. So you kind of control the time.
Right, but I should aim to end around 8:45. Is that what you're saying?
That sounds
including cool. Questions and answers.
That sounds cool.
Which, okay. Oh, good, okay. I have this idea that I'm going to gift all these various places where I talk a little clock that could be put right where the teacher can see it without it being obvious that the teacher is looking at it. And Berkeley Zen Center doesn't, they have a clock, but the teacher, you don't get to see it. The Doan gets to see it. And it's really nice because I can look at my watch, but you'll know I'm doing that. But if I'm looking at a clock that's, you know, close enough that I can read the face. Anyway, that's my complaint for the day. So I started with Yvonne Rand. I started actually as a guest at Tassajara in 1980, and I thought, well, I should go to, they have Zazen instruction every afternoon, so I thought I'd do that. Well, there was this young monk that gave the the Zazen instruction, and he had a shaved head, and he was dressed, I don't know, probably in work clothes kind of clothes. Japanese, thank you so much. In Japanese kind of work clothes. And the way it feels to me is that he started off with full lotus. I don't think he did. I mean, it seems, surely he didn't do that. But he taught us in kind of a strict way. And then with my, I'm a one on the Enneagram system. I'm a perfectionist. So I came away feeling like if I didn't do it exactly right, I should not darken the door of the Zendo. So I didn't. And then years later, I got a brochure from Green Gulch Farm. That's part of the San Francisco Zen Center, just in case. And it was it included a reference to a retreat led by Yvonne Rand. She's one of the very early students of Suzuki Roshi's, and he ordained her. And she was a stalwart of San Francisco Zen Center, by the way. And she lived at City Center. She was an officer of Zen Center. I know she was secretary. I don't know other things, but she was one of the leaders of the San Francisco Zen Center and one of the founders of the Zen Hospice Project. She was very interested in death and dying. Anyway, she was leading a retreat at Green Gulch, and it was called On Being Awake, a Mindfulness Retreat for Women. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And I went, signed up, and that night, the first night, on Friday night, we went around the group, and I think there were about 20 of us, I don't remember exactly. Anyway, we went around, and she had each of us say, you know, what brought you here? Why are you here? And I heard myself say, I thought it was time to begin. And you know, sometimes you say something that you deeply mean, but you had not yet allowed yourself to know that you meant it. You know, and you sort of want to say, shut up. I'm not ready for that. And I didn't even, you know, it just came out. I didn't even know consciously what it was that I meant to begin. And that we had a lot of Zazen instruction that weekend, and it felt like coming home. And I think what she did was start us off with a little simple Zazen instruction in this circle in the Wheelwright Center conference room at Green Gulch. And I bet you we sat about 10 minutes. I don't know. And the next morning, I think we sat again in there, and we probably sat a little longer. And then a little later in the morning, mid-morning, she took us to the Zendo, and she showed us how to get in. And it was all very gentle. You know, she wasn't, I didn't have this feeling that I had had with this young man that I better do it right. I mean, that was a lot me. It wasn't so much him, but he was very kind of a strict, and it was also what TMI, too much information, which just is intimidating because you know that you're not going to remember it. Anyway, she showed us how to get in and out of the Zendo and how to get up onto the platform where the seats were and so on. And then we sat in there for a while. And we would convene and talk. And then in the afternoon, I know one day we went for a long walk. I don't know what else. She taught us how to do Thich Nhat Hanh's kind of walking meditation. And we talked a lot. And she was very interested in 12-step programs and in Western psychology. And I came to it, to this retreat, from having been involved with Al-Anon for at least 2 years before that. And I had started thinking about, well, what do I believe? I don't believe in a higher power, but something bigger than I or something like that. So I was primed for this. And so on Sunday morning, she told us that she was giving the Dharma talk. So we were free to either, there was 9:30, which is a big public Zazen. She said we could either sit Zazen that with everybody, or we could do walking meditation in the garden, which was really nice in the sense that she wasn't insisting that we jump into that form. But I really wanted to go sit Zazen, and I was afraid because I didn't remember all the stuff she taught us or anything. And a woman standing next to me said, I want to go sit Zazen, but I'm afraid I'll make a mistake. And Yvonne roared with laughter, and she said, I hope you're prepared to make lots of mistakes. And it was like this weight lifted off of me. Oh, and that from then on, I always, when I do Zazen instruction, that's where I start. That please don't worry. And it's okay to make mistakes. And you need to be a beginner at some point, and you need to learn, and that's okay. And you're welcome. And don't worry. And I always say that. Because people, it's scary, this, especially if it's new to you. You know, maybe now, that was in 88. Maybe nowadays it's more accessible to people. But still, people are scared. And we as Americans, I don't know other cultures in this way particularly, so maybe most people are this way, but we're very afraid of making mistakes. And we get very defensive if we are corrected. We're being accused of a failing or of some sort of moral flaw because somebody says, you know, when we do Kinhin, please go in this direction. Whoop-de-doo. But it never ceases to amaze me how reactive we are. So I start with that. And I often tell that Yvonne story. And she became my first teacher. And I felt very welcomed by her. And I started going to Green Gulch every Sunday. And I found out from one of the people that was in this retreat that there was a Berkeley Zen Center about 6 blocks from where I lived. So I found it on Monday I went and found it and sort of like where the door is and stuff. And on Saturday I went to Zazen instruction there and I started sitting there. And I continued to go to Green Gulch on Sundays. And I also would go and talk to her occasionally in what's called Doksan or practice discussion or whatever. And she was supportive and insightful. And she noticed things. And that's what a teacher's supposed to do. But I don't remember what triggered it. I got tears in my eyes one time when I was talking to her. And, you know, she stopped me. I got tears in my eyes and she said, "What happened just then?" Right away. She didn't wait for me to finish the paragraph or I don't know what. Just, "What happened just then?" And I felt very much seen by her. And she was not so available. She was studying with a Tibetan teacher at that time, and she was working on receiving Dharma transmission from Katagiri Roshi. So she was gone a lot. And so I started developing a relationship with Sojin Mel Weitzman, the teacher at the Berkeley Zen Center. And eventually I was sort of more drawn there. I went to, I don't know, say it was a Wednesday night group. It was led by Maylee Scott. But, you know, Yvonne continued to be an important influence on me. And a major way that she supported me, not without even, you know, trying, it's just that her language was the language of 12 steps in the language of psychology to some extent. And Sojin at the Berkeley Zen Center, when he would get going, he would talk, he would make it sound like you should not be governed by your emotions and you should just rise above it and be equanimous. Is that a word? You know, you should just have equanimity and so on, and that you shouldn't get caught by that stuff. And it, you know, it sounded like you should not have emotions. You should be beyond emotions. And I'm listening to this and thinking, well, but I have emotion. And that it wasn't clear to me that it was a bad idea. And Yvonne was like, you know, another voice saying, it's fine to have emotions, and you work with, that's what we have to practice with. And it's important to turn towards them and go through them rather than trying to repress them and so on. And so that was tremendously empowering to me. And I want to add, just if you actually talk to Mel about it, to Sojin about it, he understood that. But, you know, when he's giving a Dharma talk, gets going, you would come away with the impression that emotions were to be overcome, or I don't know what. So that was just tremendously important to me, because at the beginning, you know, I was trying to find out, is there a place for me here? You know, I was reading about women teachers. Conversations with Remarkable Women by Lenore Friedman? It's Conversation. And the book about Buddhist history by Nancy Wilson Ross, which wasn't about women particularly, but she was a woman author, and various things. I was just, you know, wanting to know, as we looked around at that time, and all the teachers other than Yvonne that were really visible, because Blanche was she wasn't that visible at that time. Anyway, they were all men. The abbots and the directors of the various places, and Mel Sojin, and Alan, his right-hand person. So having a relationship with Yvonne was tremendously helpful. And another way that she was supportive is that I used to be a union side labor lawyer, and I was negotiating a contract with Stanford University on behalf of a service employees local that represented sort of white collar but not professional people on the campus. And the lawyer for the management was, he was very difficult. That particular local had a very contentious relationship with management at Stanford. And it was difficult, it was hard. And I got, my partner was usually represented them, but he was in the middle of a trial or something and he couldn't do it. So it was like, here, negotiate a union contract. So I remember going to see Yvonne, and it turned out her father had been like the president of Stanford or some mucky muck on the board of directors or something. Anyway, so she had some sense of Stanford. And anyway, I was talking to her, and was talking about this lawyer, and I said, he lies and steals and cheats. And I was laughing because it was meant to be kind of a joke. And she looked at me and she said, listen to your words. It was a major teaching from her. Notice your words. And listen to how much power you're giving him, how much of your power you are giving up to him by talking about him that way. You're joking, but those are the words you're using. And that was just like a, you know, light bulb went on, like, oh my Lord, it's true. And then I started working with it, and in two ways. One is she said, you know, when you're sitting with him, opposite him on this at this table, you can either say to yourself, I love you. And I said, that was a little much. I wouldn't go there. But the other one was, this man does not want to suffer. And that was really powerful. And I would sit there and say that, you know, when he was talking or other people were, you know, when I didn't have to be talking, I would be saying that. And it really helped me see him as a human being. And one of the things I realized that if he did not act like a jerk, he'd lose his job. You know, there were other management people at the table with him, and he was like the leader of that team. And that was their style, being, you know, contentious and hostile and so on. And I started to see him as a human being, and even feel a little sorry for him, because it's a drag to have to act like a jerk. That's a polite word for what I thought. But I felt like our relationship changed, and it was much better. And sometimes I felt like I was talking to him as another human being. And that was one. The other thing was for working with taking my power back. And she lent me a small statue of a Vajra Yogini, a sort of a fierce female manifestation of a Buddha. They're usually have skull necklaces around, and they'll have a skull bowl in this hand, and I think it's called a Vajra knife. It looks like what you use to make chopped chicken liver. You know, it's curved. And you know, she's like this because she's chopping the guts in this bowl, and then when she's done, it turns into ambrosia. Okay, so it's a very powerful image, and I used to do that. She's standing, I'm not going to bother getting up, she was standing like with her foot, you know, and so I, in the morning, before I got dressed, I would be doing this, whoops, I could do it better then. And that was one thing, and the other was to imagine that I had this hole here, and there was a rope attached that represented my power, and I should pull it back and just keep coiling it into my heart, basically, coiling it, and then just pat it in. And I did that too, and I imagined that. So those were very powerful, and they really stuck with me. And the stuff about words, you know, and paying attention to how we express ourselves has been something that's a core part of my teaching, which some of you may know. And also how it gets expressed. I work with lawyers, you know, and I talk to them a lot about noticing. You know, for me, I know if I start swearing a lot, if I get louder, if I talk faster, if the pitch of my voice goes up, I know that I am feeling threatened, or at least challenged, you know, and that it's time for me to figuratively step back and take a breath and exhale completely and let that go, find my ground again. And each of us, you have whatever your triggers are. But when you're paying attention and knowing where your breath is in your body, you know, when it's up here, that's because you're anxious and you can't always just make it go lower in your body, but at least you know that you better go slow. So she was very powerful for me. And as I say, I became more engaged with the Berkeley Zen Center as she wasn't around so much. And I also developed a relationship with Maile Scott. I don't know if any of you have heard of Maile Scott. I mean, you guys probably know Maile, knew Maile Scott. Maile was a long-term practitioner at the Berkeley Zen Center, and she and Fran Tribe were the first two people that Sojin ordained. And I think it was in 88 or 87. I started in March of 88, and they had just been ordained relatively recently. But, you know, when you're new, she looked like she'd always been ordained. I didn't know. Anyway, she led this group, and we met, and I think we studied things. A lot of it was sort of check-in, but also she loved the Lotus Sutra, and she taught the Lotus Sutra a lot. And so I know that we studied the Lotus Sutra, and we read from it. And she was quiet and very powerful. She's one of those people that would say, she was very politically active, and she was one of those people that would say to Sojin, we should have Dharma groups and let the senior students lead it. I mean, and the senior students could each be involved in one, and they should be coordinators. They shouldn't be leaders. But she was fine. That was Berkeley political correctness. But she was the kind of person and personality, she led that group. You call it whatever you want. She led it. And I'm sorry that I never talked with her about that, because I really disagree with her about it. And I also think, given her personality, that wasn't really fair. Because I told Sojin lots of times that I thought he needed to support the senior students to become teachers. And you become a teacher by teaching, so that they should be described as leaders of these groups and then be accountable and responsible in some way and start to be visible as leaders, as teacher kind of leaders, not as just people who cooked the dinner or did the bells or something like that. But at any rate, she led this group. I'm saying she led it. I don't remember what she called it. And I just really liked her. And she was very wise, and she was born and raised in New York, and her family was from New England, and she was a rock ribbed New Englander. She just was, and her family, she was raised as an atheist. Her parents were atheists. And she and her sister used to play church in the attic. And her sister became, I think she was the abbess or some senior part of an Episcopal Benedictine convent in England. Wow. And Maile became the founding teacher of the Arcata Zen Center. We had dinner one time, and her mother was there. And there were a bunch of people around this table, and somebody leaned forward and said to her mother, I understand that you and your husband are atheists? And she said, yeah. And then the person said, how did it happen? One daughter is a Benedictine abbess, and the other and is a senior teacher at the Berkeley Zen Center. And her mother said, I failed. And Maylee also had a good sense of humor. And she, we became more friendly, and I started going to talk with her, and she'd see people in her backyard in a big, one of those big wood shingled houses in Berkeley. You'd have tea out in the backyard, which was very sweet. And then we started having breakfast together every Monday morning after there was a practice committee meeting on Monday mornings that she was part of. And at Berkeley, they're open, so you could, I just would sort of sit in the back and listen, and then we would go. And we worked together too in the jails, and the women's jail in San Francisco, doing sort of stress reduction kind of stuff, a little yoga, a little zazen, a little check-in kind of thing. And she worked in, she used to go out to the Concord Naval Weapons Station and sit there. And she felt that her primary work was supporting people that did political work. She went off to do a practice period at Tassajara not long after she was ordained, and she felt like she used that time to kind of sit with the question, well, what kind of priest am I? What does it mean for me, Maylee Scott, to be a priest? And when she came back, she had formed this, she articulated it, and she did do that. And I mean, I am an old lefty, and so, politics were similar, but I wasn't so politically active then. I was just swallowed up in Zen. And I remember she told me once that she didn't tell people what to do, but occasionally she'd give them a little nudge. And she was very much into the Enneagram system of, I guess you call it, personality analysis. And one of her few faults was she'd tell you what your number was. You're not supposed to tell people what their number is. So that's why I know I'm a nine-ish one. Because, I was interested enough to be able to know enough about it to be able to talk to her about it or to listen to her about it, but it never really did it for me. Anyway, so we were coming back from breakfast one day back to where our cars were by the Berkeley Zen Center, and she said, I think it's time for you to start inviting your demons up. And so I did, and it was very powerful. I used to say to myself, when I sat a period of zazen, I did not think about it, but it was like it just dropped this topic into the pond. And I would say to myself, to the extent I can stand it, please come up. So I hedged my bets a little bit. And it turns out, pretty much your psyche will not allow up more than you can stand. So it's really not necessary. But it made me, it just made me feel safer. So I said, now I do it occasionally still. And when there's something that I know is fermenting down there, and I don't say it that way. Well, I don't know. I don't have to say anything anymore. I know what I'm talking about, right? And I'll just, be like, please come up. Or maybe not even. And then she went to Arcata, and she was going up there regularly, and there had been a sitting group up there for a while. And Arcata, I don't know if it's just north of Eureka, and it's like hippie land. You go up, there's all this tie-dye and young white men with dreadlocks, and they're very independent. So she fit right in, and it was perfect. Her approach was perfect, right? Because she goes in and she doesn't try to take over, and she doesn't tell anybody what to do, and slowly she starts to mold it. And in, I think it was 99, she moved up there, and it was more formally begun. So it was about the same time that I was leaving San Francisco Zen Center to go start the Vallejo Zen Center. And I went up and helped her with her first, the first Jukai that she did by herself after she had received Dharma transmission. I went up to help her with that. And that was fun, actually. She also worked in the women's prison at Dublin, which unfortunately has been in the news recently, with a lot of sexual misbehavior by one of the chaplains, even, I think, and the staff. I followed her there. She sort of recruited, since she was leaving to go to Arcata, she recruited me to do this. And we had already been working together in the San Francisco jail, so that was pretty easy. And it was quite powerful, partly because there were political prisoners there. There was I don't know how many of you are old enough to remember, but there was, and still is, I think, a Puerto Rican independence movement. And some of those people had conducted, I don't know, a sit-in in Congress, or I don't remember what they did, but it was, they got arrested and sentenced. And one of those activists was there. And I knew that from Maley, and I walk in, and he's obvious, so obvious. And I just really loved that woman. She was wonderful. She got out. They cut a horrible deal, but I mean, you could understand. But the deal was they could get out. Clinton let them out, but they had to not see each other ever again. You know, they had to be separate. So, you know, that was hard for them, but it was, you know, who can blame them for taking it? They weren't seeing each other anyway. And there was a woman named Marilyn Buck who was part of the Weather Underground and the folks that robbed Brink's truck. And somebody got, I think, yeah, it was about, the driver of the truck, I think, got killed, and then maybe one other person, I don't remember anyone. And Marilyn was, she was driving, I get it. She didn't shoot anybody, but she was involved in that. So she was there. And there was a Catholic nun that worked with the Berrigans and did their, you know, went and hammered on missiles and stuff like that. So that was pretty interesting. And she and Maley were particularly close, which you could, I mean, they were, had Maley been a Catholic, she would have been one of those people. And Maley died 20-some years ago, not that long after she got up there, unfortunately, she had liver cancer. So I had her for, well, I it was like 14 years, so it was not nothing. And she became, you know, we became friends. It was much more of a friendship. And she came the night before I was ordained. They had this thing where the women that, well, there were only two of us. We met in the women's bathroom, and a bunch of women that we had asked came and buzzed our heads. You know, so not shaving with a razor, but so that you had a 16th of an inch of hair or something like that. And she was the person that did that for me. So Blanche Hartman is the next one I want to talk about. And I don't know, I'm sure that some of you know who she was. Is there anybody who does not know who she was? Then please don't be shy. Thank you. Yes, well, yeah, there are probably other people here that are just, I don't know. Blanche was one of the senior teachers at San Francisco Zen Center. She started in the 70s. No, well, one of her formative experiences was at the San Francisco State student strike, which was in 68. So it was soon after, and so soon after that, so late 68, early 70s. She started sitting at the Berkeley Zen Center. And she came from a family of members of her father and mother were members of the Communist Party. The people of me just call that the party. And her father, they lived in the South, and Blanche was a daughter of the South. I mean, she was a communist, and she was an activist, and she was this rebellious person, and you name it. And she did not take typing, which girls did in those days. She didn't take typing because she did not want to become a secretary, and she figured this way she just would not be qualified and it would never happen. She regretted that later when she had to do, you know, like get Dharma talks together and things like that. At any rate, she was from Alabama, you know, and every so often you could hear it, especially if there were people from the South around, and I sometimes would call it Blanche. Or she would talk about her teacher, you know, a high school teacher or something, you know, and they'd call it Blanche. And then they moved out here. Her father actually got beaten, and I think they lived in New York for a while. And then they moved out here, and they were living in Davis. I think he was teaching at Davis. And she met her future husband, Lou Hartman, another wonderful person. And they met at Communist Party meetings in San Francisco and so on, and I don't know, demonstrations and you name it. And she really liked him, and she thought he was really handsome. And so he did not drive, she did, and he was living in the East Bay. So she gave him a ride home from San Francisco one time. And you probably heard this story.
No, I never
heard that. Anyway, so she drives across the bay, and then she drives on up to the hills. And they sit and look at the lights or whatever. And then he turns to her and he says, "Jim said that you think I'm cute. Is that true?" I guess she said yes. And that was the beginning of their courtship, really. And either that late that night, because she went home to Davis, but at least, you know, within 2 nights, say, he was at her bedroom window and he serenaded her. Yeah. And so they got married, and then they left the party, as many people did in 56 when Hungary was invaded, and so on and so on and so on. And she said that she got started, somebody had given her a book of poems. And I want to say Basho, but I think it wasn't Basho, but I can't remember who, but some one of those, you know, either Chinese or Japanese poets. And she read it, and she completely, Huangbo, and she completely understood it. She really felt moved by it. And she wanted to know more, you know, what is this? And her daughter was going to San Francisco State, and the strike was a huge one, and there was some violence, and there were cops on the campus. And the president at the time was a man named Hayakawa, and he was very confrontational, and he made things worse on purpose. At any rate, they had one time there was a demonstration, and the young people invited. All the parents came and stood between the students and the line of cops, and so she was right there in the front, and she had this experience that she suddenly was looking right into the eyes of this policeman who was opposite her, and she knew that he was a human being also. And you know, they had always been, you know, the pigs, I don't know, the enemy and so on. And that was striking for her. And So she was looking for some, she wanted to understand this and have more of whatever it was she experienced in the poetry. And she found the Berkeley Zen Center, which was then on Dwight Way. And so she started sitting there, and Sojin, at that time, he was, you know, he was a senior student of Suzuki Roshi's, and I don't know if he, when it started, he had not yet been ordained. And they used to all go, on Saturday mornings, they would all pile into cars and go over to San Francisco Zen Center and listen to the talks. Or they would go over to there and sit one day sittings and things. So it was a relatively informal sitting group, I think, at that point. But Mel must have, he was the leader of it. And she started sitting there. And she said, one of the things she said was years later, she reread the Huangbo and she didn't understand it at all.
Oh my gosh.
So it's like she knew enough to know what she didn't know. Maybe. And then years after that, she read it again and it completely, it was just clear to her and moved her deeply. So I think that, I don't know if she read it again. We never talked about it. And I remember a lecture she gave at Green Gulch. She lived at Green Gulch when I first met her, and she was scary. I mean, I was afraid of her, and that was a common response. And I think it's partly because she was always kind of busy, and she was like going somewhere. And she, her, you know, when she smiled, her face lit up, but otherwise, you know, it was a little stern. And it felt like you better do it right. I don't know exactly, but I know I was scared of her, and lots of people were. You know, when you, like Kathy is nodding, when you say that, people nod. At that she was there, and she was, I don't think she had an official title, and she was a sewing teacher. And she was really devoted to sewing. She had learned, she had heard that there was a woman teacher coming over from Japan, and she really wanted to be the assistant and meet this teacher and work with this woman. And so she asked if she could be, and then she found out that this woman was teaching sewing, which was not her strength. You know, you had to take typing. You also, as a girl, you had to take home ec. There were no boys in home ec. They got to take shop. Anyway, so you had cooking, and you learned to cook horrible, like white sauce. Or I remember something. I mean, I was a better cook than that already, you know, when I was 14 or whatever. And I remember one, you had a hamburger bun, and then maybe you toasted it, I don't remember, and you heated up a can of pork and beans, and then you poured that on the hamburger bun. I was like, we learned that. Anyway, so she, I don't know what she learned in terms of the cooking, but she had that she had to take a year of sewing. And the first semester, they made, I don't know, aprons and things like that. But the second semester, and it was hard for her. And I'm sure she had some resistance. If she didn't want to take typing, she probably wouldn't do thrilled about sewing. At any rate, in the second year, they were going to make a suit. And you know, the fabric is expensive and so on. The teacher approached her and said, Blanche, how would you like to refurbish the sewing machines instead of... And she was thrilled and delighted because she was a great mechanic. And so that's what she did, which comes back to this sewing teacher, Joshin-san, who came, and Blanche did get assigned to be her assistant and was happy no matter what it was. And it turned out she was really good at sewing roksus because... it's an engineering feat. And she said once, I'm not a very good sewer. I'm a strong sewer, not a very good one, but she could put it together. And when you sew it, you know, you put them backwards and then you go this way and then you go that way. And, you know, it's hard to understand it. And you can understand it. And then if you don't do it for a while, you have to relearn it. And also, she could figure out how to deal with mistakes. Like if you got, you know, you went too far with one series of thread and you needed to make a knot, You had about this much thread left, which if you have any idea about this, it doesn't work. And that if you get a really, really short needle, you can make that work. Something I learned from her. She loved it, though. She loved sewing. She loved, her practice was very much devotion practice. And she was devoted to Joshin-san. And she had a very light-hearted approach. She was totally serious about it. She didn't make people take out stitches very much at all. But she did, you know, if it really needed to happen, she did. And she was devoted to it. And she took, Joshin-san was about to leave, and Blanche came across her in the sewing room one evening, and Joshin-san was working on finishing roksus that people had abandoned. And Blanche said, "What are you doing? You're leaving tomorrow. You should be in bed," and so on. And Joshin-san did not speak that much English, and she didn't speak much Japanese, but they worked at it. Anyway, Joshin-san is looking at all these rocks and saying, "It's this one and this one and this is not, this is bad, bad, bad." And Blanche said, "I will finish them and go to bed. I swear to you, I will finish them." And she did. But she loved Joshin-san. And I want to say, you know, when you were sewing with her, it was lighthearted. Mm-hmm. And she taught you how to do it, and she did expect you to, you know, the stitches not be, you know, super far apart. She wanted them to be dots. She not lines, but dots. But, you know, if it was reasonably all right, that was okay with her, because each person's, it's your roksu and it expresses you, and she would encourage people to not take stitches out. Unless it was really bad. And it just, so it was a, just a wonderful feeling. I mean, she had a little trouble with silence. So there is that. But there just was silence. But it was a joy to sew with her. Just a joy, because her joy was infectious. And that's how I got to know her. I did a summer practice period at Green Gulch, and she was working on a big green priest robe, or a case, a fancy one, that was supposed to be sort of a generic one for the abbots to use when they led ceremonies, because they didn't have fancy ones. So she invited whoever wanted to come sew on it. So that's one of the things that I did a lot of. And so I spent a lot of time with her. And that was really, that's how I got to know her. And that's how I stopped being afraid of her. And one time, years later, she was at City Center. And she used to, during a sesshin, there'd be a work period, and their sesshins were big enough that she would collect the people that were working on roksus that were maybe a little behind, and there was a jukai ceremony coming up. They'd all go to the sewing room, and during the work period, they would be sewing. And I was the Eno. I was in charge of ceremonies and stuff, and I had some question I needed to ask her, so I'd go over to the sewing room to ask her, and I was standing there. It was a big room, and there were a couple of stairs leading up to it. And so I was standing on the lower level, and I walked in that door, and it was like a cocktail party, you know. And I just stood there, and I waited. And finally, she noticed me, and she turned around, and she said, "Busted." And I remember a talk at Green Gulch where she sang "This Little Light of Mine." That was wonderful. Anyway, she became an important friend for me. Thinking about this, you know, I really miss Maylee and I really miss Blanche. And those are really important people for me. And I don't see what time it is. Joko Beck was another important teacher for me. I sat with her twice. She was a teacher at the founding teacher of the San Diego Zen Center. She was a disciple of Maizumi Roshi's. And I don't know if you've read Everyday Zen or what's the other one?
Nothing Special.
Nothing Special. I commend them to you. Anyway, I'd read her books, and there was a chance to go down and they would sit So I sat with her for 3 days in San Diego, and then a month later, 2 days up at Oakland at her disciple Diane Rosetto's house. And she had a practice that she advocated, which was labeling thoughts. And it does not work for me. It does not, because of this perfectionism, whatever. You know, I could drive myself crazy trying to think, what category does that fit into? Is that a thought about jealousy, or is that a thought about Sally, or is that a thought about, you know? And I, at first, she saw everybody every day. So the first time I met with her, I said, I don't think I can do that. All right, you know, it makes things worse. And she knew that I was a lawyer, I think. I don't remember. Anyway, but it was like she basically said to me, "You, body." And then every time I opened my mouth for the rest of the time, seeing her every day, and then she also had like question and answer at the end of the lectures, whenever I opened my mouth and she'd say, "That's just another thought. What's going on in your body?" And it was really, really powerful. And it's also a hallmark of my teaching now. And it was really, really powerful. And when I saw her, you know, a month later in Oakland, we talked about that, the effect of it, and she was very encouraging, which was also nice, because the teachers at San Francisco Zen Center, you know, if you tell them that you had some kind of a peak experience or something, they'd say, I see, and do you like the weather today? they absolutely will not, put the stamp of approval on that or give you any kind of, and validate, thank you.
But that was their training.
That was their training, I know. Yeah. But it was nice.
Yeah.
It was really nice to be encouraged. Anyhow, she was, anyway, that, but that body, what's going on in your body? And I hadn't ever thought like that. I mean, Yvonne was some, but not like that. And she would not, you know, I'd start to describe something and she just, it was very tough. And I want to talk some about Darlene Cohen. Darlene was probably more a friend of mine than a teacher of mine. And she was a very powerful teacher. And I learned a lot from her. And she was somewhat of a rebel, and she was also very direct. And one of the things, she wasn't teaching me this, I think she talked about it in a lecture, and it stayed with me as very important teaching. She said, maybe it was a private conversation, I can't remember. At any rate, you can tell me if she talked about this publicly or not. I think she did. But what she was saying, you know, she had severe rheumatoid arthritis. Her hands were gnarled and she walked with quite a limp. And when it first struck her, she had to take to her bed. And then she got a little better. But she was still, it was hard. There were things that were difficult for her. And she talked about how every so often, she could feel a storm coming, and that she could not accelerate it. She couldn't. She could repress it for a while, but she knew that it was going to come. That she was going to fall apart, and she knew that on the other side might be insight, might be more calm or acceptance. But it didn't. She just had to kind of sit still and wait for it. And then it would come and she would really fall apart. And, you know, I don't know that she described it, but my idea is that she would cry and rail against it. You know, it's not fair. And I hate it, you know, whatever. And that was really powerful, because I know some, you know, disabled people, you know, and they're sometimes They're very jaunty jolly all the time, and they never say, I hate this. It's so hard. And of course, one would feel like complaining and also feel overwhelmed by it sometimes. I had it was called Epstein-Barr syndrome, and now it's called chronic fatigue, but you know, it went on for months, and I certainly fell apart a number of times, just, you know, how come I can't do anything? Or, you know, if I exercise, I get more tired, and you know, it's not energizing, and so on. And the honesty of that was very powerful. So is this something that you talked about much?
And
is this
lectures, I mean, in our
talk, this is not news to you, right?
Right.
Yeah.
No,
this
didn't
is
show me.
What?
She didn't show me. How
yeah. So Trish is one of her disciples. And she gave me a certain amount of unsolicited advice about how I walked, like, raise your knees, and so on. But she had a great sense of humor, and she was a very good writer. And there's one, she wrote a lot about the pain and working with pain and difficulty. And she talked about one of the things she had to, you know, really, really pay attention as she started to come back from the initial attack, really. And she learned that when she picked up her foot, it didn't hurt, you know, until she put it down again. But to notice that, to be with that not hurting. And she was a great teacher for people with physical difficulties. As she said once, that she thought that her disease had made her a deeper person. And then she said, on the whole, I'd rather be shallow. So she was really great, and she helped me. She knew a lot about sciatica, which I had, and it's available to me if I don't be careful, if I don't sit the right way and that kind of thing. And we were good friends. She did some Dharma transmissions when she was dying of cancer. And they're supposed to, towards the end, be in a room that was red, but she was pretty much in bed or on the couch. And so there was just a bunch of red silk piled all over the bed, you know. And then she was there, and at the end, they're supposed to do bows and say thank you, and bow until the teacher says, stop. And when we did it, I don't know how many bows we did, you know, six or eight, something like that. She's sitting there, and Cynthia and whoever it was, Cynthia, and I can see her face, she's in down in the peninsula. This is one of Sarita. And I think it was just the two of them then. Anyway, so they're bowing and saying thank you, and she's saying, come on. Keep it up. I don't know how many bows they did. It's at least 25. Anyway, I have to stop. It's 7 minutes too. But does anybody do you have any questions or share your experiences of these teachers? Do you want to say anything about Darlene?
Yeah. When you're talking about the feet and knees, she told me that, he could have pulled the microphone.
Oh. So the thing about picking up your feet, she would say when she'd go, it'd be so excruciating that she had to figure out another way. So she put her attention on the knees to lift, and I have used that so many times when one part of the body hurts. Instead of focusing on that one part, whatever is attached to it lifts it. Or, And it really makes a difference because you're not focusing on that pain.
Yeah.
You're focusing on something else, and it just lightens it.
Yeah.
So that was a very good
discussion. Yeah, well, and that's, you know, you can see that we received the fruits of her deep, deep mindful practice with her body.
God, yeah.
When it struck, something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Okay. Look, if you want to see, I think one of the most amazing things that Darlene taught, there, you just Google the only way I know to relieve suffering, and you'll find an article by her that I went through a period of depression some years ago, and that article just by itself helped lift me out of it. The only way I know to end suffering or relieve suffering, something like that, by Darlene Cook. If you Google all those words, it'll come up. And it's a really powerful article.
I think, did you want to say something?
Thank you so much, Mary. Mm-hmm. I was interested in your first teacher.
Yvonne?
No, excuse me, your second teacher, Bailey Scott.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Yvonne, I'm not sure. But I guess it was Yvonne. When you were railing about your negotiating partner, and she told you, look how much power you're giving this person. Could you explain that a little bit further? I'm not sure I understood.
Those words are powerful words. If somebody is willing to lie and cheat and steal, then they are very powerful. And, you know, they may pay for it and yada, yada, but they're very powerful. And they could hurt you. And that was in those words. So, you know, you may be, you think you're joking, but that's describing a powerful person, a hurtful person that can harm you.
That was not an accurate description of of that man?
No, he didn't do those things.
He was just doing his job.
I was saying that he, I'll say it this way, that he was an a-hole.
So he was.
Oh, God.
Oh, never mind.
And you want to give Dorley the.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to hear about all these women teachers in your life. But I wanted to say my teacher, Sojin Diane Martin, was ordained by Yvonne Rond.
Uh-huh, also. That's right.
Yes, and so I'm learning much more about her now through you, and also because I do the Jiso ceremony, she brought the Jiso ceremony also.
She did.
And the Jiso garden at Green Gulch Farm really now is cultivated with her statues, and I heard the story about her when she was already in dementia and I guess very close to her death, and they did a kind of a special celebration with her in the Jiso garden, and just
that's right.
Her being, maybe you were there.
Probably. No, I was invited, but I couldn't go.
Oh.
But it was, yeah, it was today. It was an official formal dedication. Of
yes,
the garden.
And I heard this from Chris Fortin that it was so amazing because she was not usually coherent, but while she was there, she just came alive and just walked through the garden and just spoke very eloquently.
Yeah.
And so, it's very wonderful.
Yeah, it is. It was. I was at her funeral, her memorial, and somebody told that. Maybe Chris. I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe.
Okay. I can't. This was a story about Blanche's husband, actually. Blanche's husband, Lou. So she started sitting, and he got interested, and he was a very heady guy. He never encountered Joko. Anyway, so Lou was reading, and so And Mel was always around the Berkeley Zen Center back then and working in the garden and stuff. So Lou approaches the Berkeley Zen Center and Mel's out in front and Lou's got this book in his hand and he's going, and Lou would tell the story. He just going, "You gotta read this book." And Mel said, "I don't have to read that book. But you can come sit with us if you want." Anyway, Blanche and Lou were a great combo. And Yvonne, I've met Diane, I don't really know her. So, and Yvonne died just a couple of years ago. It wasn't all that long ago.
And also, thank you very much. Your Jiso is now on my altar.
Oh, good. We have a lot of Jisos. It was quite something. And, So, he's sort of hinting that maybe it's time to stop.
Yeah.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the way, if you want to know more about Blanche, a year ago, the sewing teacher from San Francisco Zen Center, Tim Wicks, came over, and because we had five Roxus being sewn, three for lay transmission and two regular ones. And so he came over and he and I lectured about Blanche, and he gave one and then I gave one. And then on the third day, we had more of an open discussion. And so those are all on the Clearwater Zendo or Clearwater Zen website under podcasts. So you can find them if you're interested, because it was very powerful, and it was wonderful having him.
Her student, Zinju Earthlin Manuel, put together a book of her lectures also.
Yes.
Was that right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and they're wonderful also.
So people on Zoom, maybe you want to unmute just to say hello or goodbye. Or
nobody, did any of them want to say something? I don't think we... Okay, somebody would have noticed.
Oh, actually, I actually attended Darlene Cohen's group from San Jose. I drove up in the 90s sometime, and I was a great admirer of hers, and I consulted her. She would do individual consultations. That's how she earned her money. And one time I went and consulted with her about taking psych meds, and she said at first she was against it. And that you could solve everything on the mat, but she said you have to get to the mat. So then she was for it. I never did go on psych meds, but I thought she was amazing. That's all.
Thank you.